Ah, yes, it's that time again. Just when you think you have it all figured out, something comes along that makes you question everything. This is Unexplained Incorporated, and we are open for business. Veil. We just want to know.
Ready to believe you.
Ready to believe you. It's all true. All of it.
Yes, it's that time again. Time for your Friday night fright. This is Unexplained Incorporated, and its doors are now open. I am your host, Phantom Phil. Welcome to the show, and most importantly, welcome to October. We've been on an amazing ride for almost the past 6 months now with this podcast, and I have a feeling the month of October, which has an extra Friday, which means 5 episodes plus a 6th bonus episode posting Halloween night, the night of the second full moon, the blue moon of the month. And this is the month this show is going to go over the top. Some big announcements in the coming weeks about the accessibility and availability of additional content in regards to this show, and a lot of amazing stuff, including an event I will be attending, which you will hear about in tonight's case study. Also, if you haven't done so already, check out Twitter, Unexplained Incorporated, at PhantomPhil3. Hit me up, follow me, and check out the Unexplained Incorporated Facebook page, which is also gaining a lot of traction. And I have just posted the full lineup for October. Getting to that lineup was quite a process and a little bit messy, but it is now finalized, and there's going to be some pretty cool and spooky stuff coming your way this month. But first, tonight, it is the beginning of the month, the 2nd of October to be exact. And that means it is time for the monthly case study. Now, for those of you who have been out of the loop the last little while, the sisters, Nina and Celia, from the True Crime Paranormal Mashup podcast, they unfortunately, due to unforeseen circumstances, had to postpone their appearance until the month of November. However, after calling an audible, I have a very amazing backup plan in place, and it went off beautifully without a hitch. And I bring on a very special guest who I think just might be doing the case studies with me every month from now on, because it was a lot of fun. And it's also a familiar voice that I'm going to get to in just a second. But in the meantime, let's hear a little bit of music. All right, some of you recognize this. This is the intro, which is usually read by Amy, but this week the intro is going to be a little bit different. And with the difference in the intro, the song is going to remain the same, and I ain't talking about Led Zeppelin. This, alongside with all of the other music you hear on Unexplained Incorporated week in, week out, comes from Soundstripe.com. Soundstripe is an online subscription-based company that provides the best-sounding royalty-free music for filmmakers and online content creators. Sign up through my link, which is now going to be posted on the phantomhub.com, as well as the Unexplained Incorporated Twitter page. And I'm going to be posting that very link in the show notes each and every week, as Soundstripe is now an affiliate partner of Unexplained Incorporated. Sign up with the promo code FRIGHT, F-R-I-G-H-T, and you will receive 10% off your subscription. This is a great deal. And this track that we're listening to that accompanies the voiceover intro every week was composed by Kevin Graham. He's a frequent contributor to Soundstripe, and he's got a lot of great work. Check him out after you sign up. And this music usually accompanies not my voice, but the voice of the very special guest joining me for the October case study. And remember, if you want cinema quality, royalty-free music for your video or audio projects, sign up with Soundstripe today. Now, it is time for the October case study. That's right, folks. Phantom Phil here to say that she didn't do an intro this week because she is here joining me for this very special case study for the month of October. I was trying to find a name for her. The name Assistant Amy just wasn't going to cut it. So after putting our heads together, I would like to formally introduce you, the listeners, to Angel Card Amy, who has been doing intros for the show for the past few episodes, who's been blowing up the show on social media, especially on Twitter. Much appreciated. She helps me run the Facebook page for Unexplained Incorporated, and she is going to be permanently a monthly contributor and joining me for the case studies. So, Angel Card Amy, welcome formally to the show, even though we've heard your voice before. And you have a very special announcement about yourself before we get into this case study. So the floor is yours.
Hi, thanks, Bill. So happy to be here. I'm so glad to be a part of the podcast. I've been listening since the beginning, and it's really enjoyable.
Yep, and thank you.
So, yes. So the news that I have is I am a psychic medium in training.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And how's that going for you? And how long have you been doing it, if you don't mind me asking?
It's going pretty well, actually. I still can't believe it myself. I've always been into the paranormal. And growing up, I've had quite a few experiences not quite knowing what was going on. And then growing up, just coming all together, memories coming back. And so one day, I hope to be able to help people like myself that are going through this.
Yeah. And you've been piecing it all together slowly but surely, which has been very good for you. And myself and everyone else associated with Unexplained Incorporated wishes you the best of luck.
Well, thank you
very much. But before, there's actually one major announcement on my end that involves you and I in terms of the podcast, which I almost forgot about, believe it or not, is that you and I are going to go officially on our first paranormal investigation on Friday night, October 30th. I cannot wait for this.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, I can tell. And the reason we're doing this is that in our neck of the woods, this is for local listeners only, in the Kitchener, Ontario region, there is an art gallery known as the Homer Watson House. And it has long since been haunted, the house and the surrounding area down near the Grand River. And like everybody by COVID, they need some extra money right now. So they're having a fundraiser the night before Halloween, October 30th. And this event is known as the Psychic Soiree. I was going to wait to get tickets, but luckily yourself, Amy, and some others said, no, the tickets are going fast. You have to get in on this. And that prevented me from missing out on this paranormal experience. But it gets better than that. This is not a general admission, single ticket event. This is multiple vendors and speakers, and you get your tickets to each one on the premises, as it does take place all outdoors and is COVID safe. It has been approved by the local public health board, and there's going to be readings from actual psychics. There's going to be lectures and demos as well. There is a ghost tour, which I don't think you got tickets to, Amy, but I will be going to before the investigation. And the other big announcement is the investigation is being led by none other than one of the founding cornerstones and good friend of the podcast, RRLC Paranormal. Yeah, this is a big deal for them. They are getting back into the swing of things after the lockdown. They are doing two ghost tours, one from about 6 to 8 and then 8 till 10. The 8 o'clock tour is completely sold out. That thing went so fast. But the last I heard from Leslie Knowles was that there are some tickets still available at the 6 o'clock investigation. And some of the psychics and the ghost tours still have openings, but they are going super fast. My recommendation is check out the website for the Homer Watson House and Gallery. And I'm going to put a link to where you can buy tickets in the episode description. So if you're a local to the Kitchener, Ontario area, please click the link, buy tickets, support the Homer Watson Gallery and support RRLC. And, who knows, maybe you'll get featured on Unexplained Incorporated. And Amy, we're going to put together a bonus episode from this event, which is going to post on Halloween night. Where and how, I'm not exactly sure yet. We're going to get to that eventually. But yeah, lots of great stuff going on. And if you haven't already done so, check the Facebook page and the Twitter for the full October lineup of Unexplained Incorporated. So Amy, are you ready to get to this case? Got all the housekeeping out of the way.
Yes, Phil, I am.
Awesome. So we are going to turn the clock back to 1993. This movie was released on March 12th of that year, and it is called Fire in the Sky. And the movie takes you back in the time frame of an event that took place on November 5th, 1975 at exactly 5:49 p.m. Mountain Time. So this movie, before we get into the plot, it was directed by Robert Lieberman. And Lieberman has mostly done TV episodes. We were talking about this before recording, Amy, but he did an episode of The X-Files in 1999, and he's done episodes for Dexter and The Dead Zone. And I looked at his filmography. This is kind of funny. I didn't recognize most of his actual, you know, film index, but the one I did recognize that he also directed was D3, The Mighty Ducks Are Back.
What?
Yeah, yeah.
I used to love those movies.
Oh, I did too, but when I was like 10, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That was a long time ago, but how you go from this psychological thriller about alleged alien abduction to doing the third installment of the Mighty Ducks series, that's quite a switch.
I would say.
But before we get to the cast, though, Amy, would you not say that Lieberman did a great job directing this movie, though?
Oh, I agree totally.
Yeah, and with that being said, I think he's, like, this is a very underrated movie that's kind of been lost in the shuffle of time and under the radar, and we're going to get to why in a little while. But first, I guess the main star, the main character of the movie who plays Travis Walton, the abductee, who we're going to get to in a bit, is played by the actor D.B. Sweeney, who did quite a few films in the early 90s. And it's so funny. Here are my notes. I keep saying at this age, because he's still pretty young here, D.B. Sweeney to me looks like a clone of Paul Rudd. What do you think?
Yeah, when I was looking at the photo on IMDb, I'm like, is that Paul Rudd? Especially when I was watching the movie, I had to rewind it. I'm like, then I had to Google it, like, okay, no, it's not Paul Rudd.
Okay, so it wasn't just me then. That's good, no. Because I swear, he's like a spitting image of him in this movie. It's so funny. Throughout my notes, I have a couple of sections that says D.B. Sweeney and Paul Rudd are the same person. So, I mean, they easily both could have been cast in this role. And then, of course, the other main character is played brilliantly by the one and only Robert Patrick, who is best known. He has a lot of great movie roles under his belt, but he is best known as being the T-1000, the liquid cyborg in Terminator 2, which, for my money, one of the great action movies ever made. And I think this is one of Patrick's first serious dramatic roles, and I think he was really fresh off of Terminator 2 when he took this role, so it was a very good move for him, I think.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah, and rounding out the cast, Craig Sheffer, Peter Berg, who would go on to become actually an acclaimed director, but this is still when he was in his acting days. And of course, one of the crew, we get Henry Thomas, the boy wonder from E.T. himself.
I know that. I thought that was kind of funny, him being in that.
Yeah, like, what kind of a sick, ironic joke is it putting in the boy from E.T. all grown up in this movie, which is about extraterrestrials that are not benevolent, but I would classify as malevolent, if you're going to get to. And no, he doesn't get abducted or encounter the aliens, but he's one of the main core people in the story. And how about this one? This one took me by surprise when I was watching the film, because I completely forgot he was in it. But the legendary James Garner plays Detective Frank Waters in this one, the state detective, and he is excellent in this movie. His performance,
it was a great performance. I liked him a lot in this.
And you know, this is Rockford Files, Maverick. You know, Garner's also was in The Great Escape. He's a star mostly from the 60s and the 70s, but here he plays the old grizzled detective who's seen everything and knows that something is awry. And I think you could say his role is the primary example of the skeptic, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But a very nice addition, having him in there as well. So now, before you and I compare notes of the movie, Amy, we're going to do a little backstory, because this is one of those things that has been well-documented is based on a true story, which is obvious, because otherwise, you know, we wouldn't be doing a case study on it here. So the book... Excuse me, the movie, I'm jumping the gun here. The movie is based off of the book, also called Fire in the Sky, which was written by Travis Walton himself in 1978, which is 3 years after this alleged abduction took place. And Travis Walton, that is his real name, and that is the character name in the movie. There is no change there. And he got approached in the early 90s by a writer named Tracy Tormé, to turn his book into a movie script. And you're going to like this, Amy. Some of Tracy Tormé's resume includes Star Trek The Next Generation and your favorite show from the 90s, Sliders.
Nice. You mean Sliders.
And at that point, I think you should tell the listeners about your other podcast appearance before coming on here that involves Sliders.
Oh, yes. So I was recently on The Jose Show. Hi, Jose. He's a really cool guy. And we have this family on Facebook for Sliders. And we usually do rewatches. And he does talk about Sliders on his podcast. And I was recently on there a few weeks ago just talking about the show.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, what I remember from that show, I didn't watch it, but I remembered that there was a lot of outrage when Fox canceled it, because it was very popular and it had a big following. But we're going to get to Fox TV a little bit later on, as they kind of relate into the background of this. But I thought you'd get a kick out of me bringing that up with your Sliders knowledge. So I had to throw that in there.
That's awesome.
So this incident, it's known as, at least in America, the second great famous alien abduction story of the modern times. The first one being Barney and Betty Hill, which I could be wrong about this, but I think was in the 50s or the 60s. This one took place in the mid to late 70s. And we're going to get to this later on, but some skeptics suggest that the Barney and Betty Hill story may have played a major influence in the events that got recited here, but more on that later. And where did this abduction allegedly take place? In the White Mountains of northeastern Arizona. It's not that far from Sunrise Mountain Resort and Mount Baldy. Now, I want to say something about the state of Arizona. My family has some property down there, just east of Phoenix. And I've been around to a significant portion of the state, not the whole thing. But Phoenix and area is all desert. It's dry. It's very humid. But the further north you go into the state of Arizona, it starts to somewhat look like the Pacific Northwest. Like there's a lot of trees, a lot of vegetation, a lot of mountains. And even in some areas, believe it or not, they do get some snowfall, which, you know, surprises a lot of people. But this is the type of area that the White Mountains is located in. And it's near the Fort Apache Reservation and the Site Greaves National Forest, which we see a sign of in the movie. And I don't want to give away too much right now, but someone who is connected to the Apache people in Arizona and who has had some strange experiences will be coming on the podcast most likely in November. So that's going to be really exciting as well. And like I said, there's some snowfall in the northern part of the state. The town that this took place near, a really, really small town, ironically, is called Snowflake, Arizona.
Interesting.
And, yeah, it's not named after, you know, soft people who can't handle conflict. I think it's just because it's up near the mountains. Now, here's something interesting. I don't know if you watched to the very end of the credits, Amy, but this movie, it was very convincingly, it looked very much like northeastern Arizona or the northern part of Arizona, which I've driven through some myself, but it was filmed in Roseburg and Oakland, Oregon.
Oh, wow.
So it really was filmed in the Pacific Northwest instead of the state of Arizona. Why that is, I don't know. One theory I have is that maybe the locals in and around Snowflake in the White Mountains areas have had enough media people and UFO nuts come through over the years, and they just didn't get the permits and the permission to film there. That's my guess.
Yeah.
But irregardless, I've never been to the state of Oregon, but I imagine some of it looks very similar to northeastern Arizona. So it was a very good fit, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. All right. So now that we got that out of the way, I love what they do at the very beginning of this movie. I don't know what it is, but when you watch a movie that, you know, is somewhat thought-provoking and they put a quote up at the beginning of the screen and then you see how that quote ties in later on, I love when that happens. And that happens here with this movie. From the philosopher Seneca, who I believe was a philosopher anyway, I could be wrong about that, but it sounds like such a philosophical quote. And this is the quote that starts the movie and lays the foundation for the story. Quote, "Chance makes a plaything of a man's life," end quote. In your opinion, Amy, how does this quote relate to the movie? Because I think we're going to have a very similar answer to this, but it can be interpreted in so many different ways.
Yeah. I think... Sorry, lost my thought there for a second.
No, that's okay. So, I mean, it does relate to the mindset of Travis Walton, at least.
Oh, yes.
With the character in this movie, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, when he gets out of the car and has no fear, and then everyone else is just telling him, no, stay in the car, don't go out there.
That's right.
So take chances at your own risk.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll get to this, but that comes up full circle at the ending too. And I really love, even though it's Hollywood and it may not be how things actually went down, it bookends the story really nicely. So, I mean, yeah, the chance, Travis taking a chance ends up being very dangerous to him and ends up changing the course of a county in Arizona. But if he didn't take that chance, we wouldn't be talking about him right now, would we? And neither would a lot of other people. And maybe he wanted it that way, maybe not. We're going to explore that. Such an amazing quote to start this movie, and it really sets the tone. So at this moment, Amy, we'll get you to share some of your notes and your thoughts, and we'll go back and forth as to why we both think this is an underrated gem of a film. mostly.
Yeah. Yeah. I first saw the movie in high school, when I was in high school. Mm. It was very terrifying from when I saw it.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, watching it again was, wow. they did such a great job on this movie. I myself would not have gotten out of the car.
Yeah. Some people I've been talking to have said the exact same thing. But when you're mm-hmm. in that situation, do you really know for sure? It's a tough one.
Yeah, true.
But you seem pretty sure about your decision, so we'll see. Yeah.
Nope. If you see something in the woods you're not too sure of, don't do it.
Yeah. But yeah, continue.
Yeah, so I like how they had the flashbacks right away once the alien abduction took place, and then they were showing what happened before the abduction.
Yeah, I just want to clarify that before you continue. So this starts out more or less with there's five guys, I think, that were on the six. Crew with him. Was it six?
Six crew members, yes.
So basically how the story goes is there's a crew of loggers who are out on a contract job out in these mountains. And in between jobs at the end of the day, they see what they think is a fire, this pulsing red light in the forest. And when they get closer, they pull up to what is believed to be like a flying saucer in suspended animation. And one person in a pickup truck full of six guys gets out. And that person, as we discussed, who takes the chance is Travis Walton. And this thing just hovered over him for a matter of minutes and then shoots a beam of white light out and pretty much knocks him unconscious. And in the movie, and allegedly what happened in real life, all of his coworkers, friends panic and they hit the gas of the pickup truck and they take off down the highway and they just leave him there.
Well, they thought he was dead. That's why they left.
So I had a bit of a, you know, dramatic conversation with someone about this recently, breaking this down, and they felt they were in a very strong opinionated way that they would have gotten out of the truck to go and check on him, or at least to see if he had a pulse. Mm. Now, it seems like a common sense type of thing to do, but if you're in that situation and you see something like that, I don't know if anything can prepare you for it, and I don't know what any individual would actually say and do in that situation. However, just hitting the gas and taking off may be the worst possible scenario on a short list of things to do in that situation. Yeah. I mean, if you check on him and you see that he's dead or he's not breathing, and then you hightail it out of there, it's going to look bad on you to the cops or the ambulance, whoever you call. But if you just leave without checking on him, I think that makes you look worse. It's a tough call. It's a tough call, right? I mean, I don't know if anyone could really say what they would do in that situation. Mm-hmm. But what it does is, the beginning of the movie, these men who hightailed it out of there meet up in a local bar, and then the cops eventually catch up with them, and they have like an interrogation scene where they give their version of the story, and then we go to the flashbacks. But you're right. One major positive of this movie is that this isn't a straight linear narration from A to B to C. The story jumps all over the place, but it doesn't do it to the point where it confuses you. It leaves you intrigued and wanting more, wouldn't you say?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Because it shows his life before the abduction happened, and then...
Yeah.
Or during the abduction, sorry. Mm-hmm. Like, once he got passed out, Pat was passed out, and then they just did the flashback right away.
Yeah, and what's really cool is once they show the flashback of the incident I just talked about, you get to see how these characters interact with each other and how their lives have pretty much been turned upside down by this. Mm-hmm. And for almost the next hour of the movie, like, you don't see Travis at all. You have no idea where he is or like where the story's going unless you're familiar with the actual case. Mm-hmm. And they do a really good job of that. So here's a bit of a thing of trivia, is that did you know that at the time in 75, when they finally sent out a search party for Travis Walton, that it was the largest manhunt in the history of Arizona?
I think I did hear that.
Yeah, and they still couldn't find him. It was, I believe, 5 days, correct?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, okay.
And then I was also watching an interview with him, or read online, that it said, like, the pine needles, there was no mess of the pine needles.
Oh.
When the beam hit him, and he landed on his back, and nothing disruptive.
Like, they didn't find any holes or burn marks in the ground, did they?
No.
From what I understand. Yeah, that is
it was all clean. It was all clean.
Yeah, like, that's really, really strange right there. I don't know how to explain that one. Here's a couple of things I liked about the film that I want to bring up that happened early on. Is there's some good scenes of foreshadowing here. I always love a good foreshadowing reference if it's done properly. And the first one being is when we get introduced to James Garner's character, Frank Waters. He stopped at a railroad crossing. I always have trouble with that word. And he's got this look of terror on his face. And then you see red lights go into his the reflection of his windshield. But all it is the barricades of the train going down, which alludes to the red light we eventually see in the forest. Hence the title, Fire in the Sky. And I don't know if you picked up on this one, too, because you kind of have to look really closely for it, is that when all six men are on their way to the beginning stages of the logging job, one guy in the back is reading a tabloid and talking about some ridiculous stuff. But if you look very closely on the front cover, on the top corner of the tabloid, it says man abducted by aliens.
Is that guy that was in the woods that they show one person watching them? Because I noticed in the movie there was one person that was in the woods, and it was really creepy. Like, he was just staring at them.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because I'd kind of forgotten about that, and they didn't really have a payoff to that, did they?
No.
Yeah, because he's a big guy, and he looks like he's, you know, Aboriginal, could be part of the Navajo tribe or something, but yeah, I thought that was going to lead to something, and then it never did.
I know, like, when he's, like, kind of blending in with the trees, and you almost don't see him, but just the way the camera moved, it's like, wait, who's that?
Yeah, that was some strange loose end that never got tied up. But yeah, very interesting. Where I was going with the tabloid, though, was after the interrogation scene is done and the sheriff and Detective Waters are trying to say if they're trying to decide what's going on, because these guys, they're all allegedly under investigation for murder because they think they've killed Travis for one reason or another, or at least one of them has, and they all collaborated to hide the body when, in fact, they really don't know what's going on. But this very tabloid outside of the bar, James Garner sees it and picks it up out of the back seat with the open window of their truck. And he says, I think this whole flying saucer thing sounds like a good story. And then he shows the sheriff the cover of the tabloid, which we saw earlier, is to say, he's not buying any of this potential abduction story. He thinks somebody murdered Travis Walton and he's going to find out who it is. So,
and they think that it was, Alan Dallas, as he had a criminal record.
And not only that, there's a very good establishing scene while they are on the logging job of Dallas and Travis Walton almost getting into a fist fight with each other and almost having this really badass, bizarre chainsaw duel. I actually wanted to see them go at it full force with the chainsaws, but it doesn't escalate to that point, unfortunately. But it's just to let you know that even though he doesn't do anything to Travis, he really looks like a guilty member of the party, and he plays a bigger role in how the story unfolds later on. So that was definitely worth mentioning. Before we move on, what else did you like about the movie? Because there's a couple of things I want to bring up that I wasn't big on. But before we get to that, anything else on your end? Or?
I did like how they showed what he remembered of being up in the spacecraft.
Yeah.
That was like the climax of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of movies where you're expecting to see a UFO or an alien, the really good ones tend to save that to the very end. Mm-hmm. It's like the big payoff. And that's how they did it with this one, because throughout the movie, we see, at least when Travis comes back and gets taken to the hospital, he's having mm-hmm. like some shell shock, some PTSD, and we're getting glimpses of his memory and what was on the ship. But we only get small glimpses up until right near the end when he has a total meltdown, and then we get to see everything that went on, which is in the last like 15 mm-hmm. minutes of the movie or whatever. And it's really well done. I'm going to say this. I thought, and because the aliens in this movie look super creepy mm-hmm. because they almost look human.
Yeah. That was, you guys got to watch it to see it. It's just, no.
Yeah. Us describing it almost wouldn't do justice. It is worth seeing. And one of the scariest things, and here's the thing though, if you really switch your mind off, are they trying to hurt Travis, or are they just trying to find stuff out about him and trying to protect him?
I don't know. They seem very a bit gentle with him, but yet how can you be gentle when he's getting a needle stuck in his eye? That part was...
And another interesting thing about that whole scene was is that... when Travis runs into them on the ship, they don't seem threatening until he provokes them and tries to run away. And then that's when they just kind of go crazy on him. Mm-hmm. And I always wonder, too, if these things were represented to look like they were communicating telepathically. Because when they got him down on the table and they're setting him up for all the gruesome-looking experiments, mm-hmm. it's so weird how, like, these things look half-human. They're tiny, mm-hmm. but they have like this reptilian looking skin, and they're looking around and there's no expression on their face, but they look and nod at each other. Mm-hmm. Like what I'm doing on the video right now, just a nod, and they don't say anything. And that really creeped me out.
you have to watch it.
Yeah. And a few others I've seen or that I know have seen the movie, they just gave me your exact reaction, Amy. So I mean,
Yeah,
it's very unsettling to say the least, but they did a really good job at projecting it. And I also think Lieberman did a really good job at not showing too much at once or not extending them. Less was more in this situation.
Yeah, that's what I read also online. And when he was coming out of that cocoon with all the goo and stuff that was in there and trying to crawl his way out.
Yeah, and it's a pretty long scene, too, but it kind of ties everything together. And mm-hmm. from what I understand, it's pretty close to what Travis described happened on the ship mm-hmm. during his abduction. So overall, a very good film with mm-hmm. some, and it's about an hour and 49 minutes. It's just under 2 hours, but it doesn't drag that often. It's pretty well put together, good characters, good interaction, good pacing, not a lot of overkill and ridiculousness, like with the aliens. Cause sometimes when a monster is revealed at the end of a movie, it can look terrible.
Oh, I know.
Like if you remember back in July when I talked about Amityville Horror, and then when they made the third one with the 3D glasses and then the demons popping out of the basement floor, and it looks so bad.
Was that the one with Ryan Reynolds?
No. That's the recent 2014 remake. This third one was back in like the 82, 83, back when 3D glasses were all the face, but that's a whole other discussion. But thankfully they didn't do anything that ridiculous in this movie, and it is very effective. I'm going to talk very quickly about two things I didn't like about this movie though. Number one, the one you brought up earlier, which I'm glad you did because I forgot, about the strange looking Aboriginal guy in the forest who looks like he's going to be a major part of the story and then vanishes.
Like Bigfoot. Explanation.
Yeah, almost like Bigfoot. Yeah.
It's Bigfoot.
Yeah. Very bizarre detail. And you know what scene? There's only one scene in this movie that really bugged me. And so there's a big thing. We're going to get into this more a little bit later, but Detective Waters gets the six guys. He's trying to get them to plead for a deal. He says, there's a consideration we'll drop the charges that you're potentially under if you all take a polygraph test. Mm-hmm. And of course, early on, they refuse and they're like, no way. And it's this good back and forth. But the scene where they finally agree to do it, I think is pretty bad. Like, I think it's really cheesy and it's out of place in the film. And I think they did it this way just to save time and move the story along. It's the scene where the police and the local, I don't know, politicians, I guess, are trying to brief people on the townspeople of Snowflake of what's really going on. And apparently the entire town fits in this small church. Mm-hmm. Everybody from the towns, they're all complaining about how unsafe it is. And and then Robert Patrick's character comes in, and like I said, his performance in this movie is really solid, really amazing. But the dialogue they give him in this scene is so cringeworthy. And he goes on this semi-heroic, patriotic rant about how, you know, he hasn't done anything wrong and blah, blah, blah. We don't want to hurt you people. And because of that, we agree to take your lie detector test. And it's so, it's such a terrible scene, and it's really out of place in the movie. But I think they did it just to create some drama in the middle in what would have been a dry part of the movie and to move the story along. I wasn't a fan of it, though. What are your thoughts?
No, I agree and disagree. I didn't mind the scene. I thought it was the thing to do, that he came in front of the whole town, and since the whole town was accusing them all of murder, and at least he got to say he got to say what he wanted to say in front of them.
Sure.
Some of it was cringeworthy, but I did kind of have a little tear in my eye. I'm very emotional when watching movies like that.
Oh, fair enough.
But in a way,
it
was a little cringeworthy.
I respect your viewpoint and your opinion. It's just, that is just one scene in this movie where I was taking my notes and I just said, oh, come on. This is a little too much. But I mean, there are movies out there where every single scene and major arc in the story is like that. So I can't complain too much, but I want.
Well, I don't know. I cried at the last Insidious movie, so I don't know what's wrong with me.
Well, hey, you're connected to spirit pretty heavily, so your emotions kind of run all over the place. You're allowed to.
Maybe that's why. Who cries at a horror movie?
That's possible. You never know. This is Unexplained Incorporated. We're not here to judge. So, that pretty much does it up for the summarization of the movie, unless you have anything to add, Amy. If you don't, we're just going to move on to the true story that the movie is based on, which is over.
I think that's good.
You think we covered it all? I think we covered it all pretty good, too. I mean, we have to give spoilers on these episodes, but I want to give people just enough to can go check out the movie, especially after we get into the story behind the story.
Yeah. Well, however, near the end of the movie, it did say that Mike left town.
Yeah.
And then Travis went to go visit Mike because he married Mike's sister. And he just wanted to let him know that he didn't blame them. And he would have done the same thing if he was in their situation.
Right.
That it's not their fault for leaving.
Yeah, for sure. In some of my research, Travis Walton a few years ago now, sometime in the 2010s, did an interview with the Hannibal TV, which is a very famous YouTube channel. I didn't get to watch the whole thing because it's very long, but I found a clip where he was talking about some of the discrepancies of the movie compared to his book, because there's always something. However, I was pleasantly surprised to see that the discrepancies, according to Travis Walton, were quite minor, which meant that they did a very good job overall staying true to his story. And some of the ones he brought up were like, instead of 6 logging crew members, there were 7. I don't know how 7 all piled into one pickup truck like that, but apparently.
Maybe it was the guy standing in the trees.
Yeah, that's our story and we're sticking to it. And he also said too that after doing days of physical work, their bodies and mentally, they were like wide awake. Like, you know, in the movie, they're kind of drowsy and they're not sure what they're seeing when they stumble upon the ship. Well, apparently he said they were wired and wide awake from the work. So He said that wasn't accurate, and this is a big one. He said another inaccuracy that was just added for Hollywood effect. He said on the ship there was no zero gravity. So he wasn't floating anywhere. Like, he floats in the... Once he breaks out of, you know, his cocoon or whatever. Apparently that was completely put in for dramatic effect. But in a way, I'm glad they put it in because it did enhance the dramatic effect and it looked really cool. So I'm kind of glad that they did it. So some other things Travis mentioned. This is from a clip in 2012 on Open Minds TV, which is a show on YouTube that does a lot of alien UFO talk. He kind of changes his story about what happened to him. He doesn't call it an alien abduction. He calls it, he refers to it as an ambulance call. Like, he seems to think nowadays that instead of being abducted and being experimented on, he feels that he was maybe chosen or saved by being put on the ship, and that this is one of those defining life experiences he had to go through, and they knew it or something. So I find it very interesting. I'm just hitting the mic apparently, but he changed his mind. He decided not to look at it through the eyes of a victim, which I find very interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, not sure what brought him to that point, but I thought it was worth bringing up. And here's the thing too. Travis Walton, no doubt, he was a logger. He was a simple blue-collar man. And by simple, I don't mean dumb. Just, you know, a hard-working guy who wanted to live a regular life. And through this, his life changed, obviously. He puts out the book Fire in the Sky in 1978. And eventually, he appears at all sorts of conventions, media appearances, TV interviews. And the role of the media in this movie is quite interesting, and the researchers, because they just appear to be totally intrusive to the whole thing, right? In the movie? Overrunning this small town. And remember that guy from, like, the Aeronautical Research Center who tries to interview him, and he's, like, totally creepy?
I mean, like, pushes him back into the bathroom and, like, trying to get an interview. Meanwhile, he's, like, freaking out naked.
And the dude looks, he almost looks alien himself. Like, there's something awful with the guy.
I didn't like that guy.
Hey, maybe the guy in the forest was connected to that organization.
We'll have to do another segment, The Guy in the Forest from Fire in the Sky.
Oh, this random guy in the forest and Fire in the Sky. But my point is that even though Walton was harassed and traumatized by local media, he eventually would embrace it, and he would appear at conferences, star in documentaries. And in Arizona, he has an annual UFO conference called the Skyfire Summit. And I think what he wants to do is he wants to create an environment where other people who have went through his experiences can share their experiences, and he can help them through it. So,
oh, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I think the silver lining is that he did find a higher purpose in his life from going through this. And the few interviews I watched with him, he seems very on the level. His eye contact doesn't wander. His cadence, his speaking is very consistent. It's not all up and down and all over the place. And just from what I've seen, I have every reason to believe that his story is most likely legit. And this guy, he's kind of made a second career out of this and monetized financial gain from this experience. But like, he still seems like a very grounded, down-to-earth guy who went through an abnormal experience, not someone who lost their mind and decided they're going to make something up for the sake of getting attention.
Yeah,
I had a feeling you would agree with me on that one, Amy. But
for sure.
Yeah. One of the documentaries he starred in was from 2015, The True Story of Travis Walton, directed by Jen Stein. That's a major piece in his story. And, of course, Amy, this wouldn't be a true case study on Unexplained Incorporated until we got the perspective from the good old skeptics.
Yeah.
And no disrespect to the skeptics, as we know, Ben Radford, he's a very good friend of the show. He's been very good to me, and I love his viewpoints, even the ones I don't agree with. But here's an interesting thing I found in the research of the people who tried to debunk this story. First thing, I found it really interesting that there wasn't a whole lot of skeptical material on this case out there, or at least not as much as I thought there was going to be, because when you do other famous stories like this, skeptics are in on it like that. And there's numerous articles, videos. I didn't find nearly as many with this one, which I found very intriguing.
Neither did I.
Yeah, yeah, I remember you telling me that earlier. So here is some of the stuff I found, though. And it is what it is, but, you know, we'll give it the time of day. But I don't know if I totally buy the viewpoints, the skeptic viewpoints I've found on this so far. Who knows? Maybe Ben Radford would present a more compelling case if he hasn't done so in his podcast already. You never know. So one of the critics of the Travis Walton story, which turned into Fire in the Sky, was from a gentleman by the name of Philip J. Klass, who is known as the quote-unquote Sherlock Holmes of UFO investigations, or UFOlogy. He says he has found several discrepancies in Travis's story and thinks he is into it for the money, and all the other guys as well. Here's a point to kind of back that up. Allegedly, the National Enquirer, you remember that tabloid?
Yep.
That used to be in every supermarket in like the 70s and the 80s, I think. apparently, they awarded Travis Walton and his co-workers $5,000 each for that year's best UFO story. And the Enquirer is known as being a bit of a joke. It's not very credible. And I think it's taken some true stories over the years and just embellished them to the point of ludicrousness. But here's what's funny about that. I mean, that does tie into Klass's argument that he just did this for money. You have to think about it. In today's standards, if you're going to do a publicity stunt for money, $5,000 really isn't going to last you very long.
No.
And even back then, it's a lot more money in the late 70s. I understand that. But that's not exactly the cash out you're looking for if you're doing this all as a publicity stunt for money. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like,
it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And I want to say something real quick about the discrepancies in Travis's story. You joked with me when we were prepping for this that you found him on social media and that we should have him on the show. Which I wouldn't be opposed to, but I stopped and I said, you know what? This guy has probably done thousands of interviews about this.
Yeah, I
doubt he's going to come talk to us, so we'll just leave it alone for now.
Yeah.
Let the man have his peace, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
But, I mean, here's the thing. This past weekend, it was a 20-year anniversary of what was almost a very serious car accident I had when I was about 17. I totaled a car driving back to work from a lunch break I was on. And luckily it was, you know, it was all proprietary damage. Nobody got hurt, which was pretty amazing. But I had to do several statements and interviews for that. And when I've told people this story that I've chosen to tell it to in the last two decades, I have a feeling my recounts and what I perceive as facts from that day have probably changed.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was a traumatic event in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure my story has changed a time or two, or certain details have changed, but the core basis of the story hasn't. That is something I'll never forget. The brace of impact and the aftermath of the whole thing. The certain details of it, yeah, I probably forget, or I probably don't have right. I think the same will go for Travis Walton, especially if he got taken aboard a mothership had God knows what done to him. So that's my only problem with that. Oh, well, there's discrepancies in his story. I think there's discrepancies in everybody's story over decades and decades of time, but that's just my opinion.
No, I agree.
Yeah, all right. Here's another hot button topic. We talked about this earlier, and it's very important we bring it up.
Okay.
As we're going to have this come to a close fairly soon. It's been fun, but we're almost getting ended here. We have to talk about the polygraph for a second. So,
yes, I was going to mention that.
Yeah, did you mention the... Because remember, we started the movie with a quote, mm-hmm. but the movie ends with a graphic with some factual evidence about the story.
Yes. I think... Right now I'm having a brain freeze.
Well, it's about the polygraphs.
Yeah, I think that in the beginning it was like inconclusive or something, and then they did it maybe 3 times, and then they all passed.
Yeah, this movie was released in 1993, remember? Mm-hmm. They said all the gentlemen involved in this story took 3 separate lie detectors tests, polygraph tests, over the years, and they all passed.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an interesting one. I found out apparently Travis Walton did an appearance on the short-lived Fox game show Moment of Truth in 2005. Did you ever watch that show? I never did.
I heard about it. I might have watched a couple.
Okay, because that's not my type of television. So like,
I never watched one checked episode. Out.
But apparently on there, Travis allegedly failed a polygraph.
Oh wow!
He asked about this. But here's the thing. Fox, like any other major news corporation, media conglomerate, can fix these things and manipulate these things. So
mm-hmm.
you have to wonder if that's a very credible source, which I will say it is not. And in 2017, I guess Travis finally had enough, as at one of his conferences, he went on a real tirade against the skeptics and the people who don't believe his story. Mm-hmm. And he says at that point in time, and this is only, 2 to 3 years ago, that he has taken a total of 16 different polygraph tests and he has passed all of them.
Wow, that's amazing. When talking
this story. So, I don't know. That's kind of hard to dispute, but I'm sure there's somebody out there saying, oh yeah, but you can beat a polygraph test. Well, guess what? I decided to do a little bit of digging on this to see how hard it actually is. Forget about, 16 times, how hard it is to beat and cheat one polygraph test. So I'm going to run a little thing by you now. This is from a stat from the American Polygraph Association. Something tells me their union has some really interesting dinners and conversations. But they've administered that their tests, the polygraph tests, have a 90% accuracy rate when done properly. Hmm. Some critics will say, well, it's actually only 70%, but how you measure a percentage at that point, I don't even know. But this is all stats from Google, okay? So even though it's statistically really hard to cheat a polygraph, it isn't impossible.
Hmm.
And that's another thing. Philip Klass claims that Travis held his breath to trick the polygraph machine, and that's how he's been able to pass so many.
Oh, my God.
Is this the case? I don't know. But I'm going to run these little stats by you, and we'll see what you think. So this is from the wonderful YouTube channel Brightside, which does these cool animated videos about just about anything you could think of.
Mm-hmm.
And here's some tips on how to beat a polygraph. This is not condoned by Unexplained Incorporated. This is for research and entertainment purposes only. Don't commit a murder and lie about it. We are not going to be held responsible. All right? No. That's all of that.
Please, no.
No, absolutely not. So apparently, they say to be physically ready and prepared. Make sure you feel a little bit nervous, which I'm sure is not an issue because you're going to be nervous no matter what being hooked up to that thing.
Yeah.
Don't lie about details. Don't rush. Go to your happy place. Imagine something pleasant that will get you relaxed.
Hmm.
And don't use physical tricks. So basically, it's telling you to stay present and stay calm. And like I said, the interviews I watched with Travis, he seems pretty grounded, pleasant, and calm. And if you think about it, if he has taken 16 different polygraph tests, the amount of energy and will it would take to lie all those times and to lie to all the appearances and the conventions he's done. It would take a toll out of him. And
I was just thinking the same.
Yeah, I don't know his exact age, but whatever it is, he looks pretty good for his age. Mm-hmm. And if he spent all that time and energy lying for the last, you know, 35 years, I don't think he'd look physically as good as he does now.
No, it's like, give him another one when he's 90.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he's going to take any more, but I know some of the other guys, the eyewitnesses around 2017, 2018, have gone on record saying they are giving their final interviews about this case because they are just so sick and tired of talking about it at this point. But either way, this is a really fascinating story and a really fascinating movie and was a real trailblazer for the UFO community, and I'm sure inspired and helped out people who had similar tales of abduction themselves, wouldn't you think?
Yes, for sure. I recommend watching it.
I mean, I do too. It's, you know, we're going back to the old throwback Siskel and Ebert days, but I think we give it two thumbs up each. Yes, because there's a couple of case studies that I did a real number on a couple of the movies, but this isn't one of them. Mm-hmm. This was, like Slenderman. This one, did not enjoy the Slenderman movie. I really enjoyed this one, though. And the True Crime Paranormal Mashup, we wish them all the best, and we're going to see them in November. So
yes, we hope you feel better.
Yeah, absolutely. Couple of other connections, and then we're going to wrap up, Amy. Thank you for taking the time. I think this is really fun having a back and forth on this instead of me just yelling into a microphone in front of a wall, you know?
Yeah, it was fun.
I prefer it anyway, and hopefully the listeners do as well.
Yeah.
I hope it catches on with everyone else who tunes in. Mm-hmm. So on September 10th, 1993, another significant happening in this world took place. The X-Files. Very first episode debuted on Fox on that day. And I said this to you before we recorded. I was really into that show for like a good 3 or 4 year span. Mm-hmm. And it caught on fire in North America and all across the world. And it really put a lot of eyes on the phenomenon of UFOs and alien abduction. And I almost feel like Fire in the Sky was like the setup. It was like the appetizer to the main course to what would become the X-Files and the cultural phenomenon it would eventually end up being.
Yeah. I used to like that show too.
Yeah. And I find it so cool that both of those came out in the same year. And then I'm pretty sure through the X-Files, Travis Walton was able to piggyback some more appearances and more sales. Because that show opened up people to his story, I'm sure. Yeah. And finally, for all my motivational metal followers out there on the phantomhub.com, love you guys. I have to apologize, though, because last week I completely forgot to post any motivational metal. So I'm going to post two tonight after you listen to this show. But I bring it up because even though this song has nothing to do with the movie or the case we were talking about, check out Ozzy Osbourne's 1988 No Rest for the Wicked album. There's a deep album cut on there called Fire in the Sky. Uh-huh. And it's a cool song, and it's got wicked, shreddy, shred-tastic guitar solo from the man, the myth, the legend, Zakk Wylde. And I just wanted to bring that up for no particular reason. Like, this song has literally no connection to the movie, but it had the same song title, and I just had to throw that in there and apologize for being behind on motivational metal, because it's one of my favorite ongoing features of the phantomhub.com.
I love Ozzy Osbourne.
yeah, how can you not? And as the time of recording this, apparently he's gonna finish writing yet another album, even though one just came out in February, so I can't wait for that. And Amy, thank you again for taking the time. I cannot wait to go out with you on the 30th. And you know what else is crazy? Yeah, she's doing the ghost hands. She's excited. You know what else I thought that's kind of crazy? We obviously met through our connection with Amanda Drago. And through you being my most loyal listener from day one, thank you again. But the 30th is going to be the first time we will meet face-to-face in person on this investigation because of COVID and the lockdown. Yeah. And that's going to be really fun. Like, how crazy is that?
I know. I can't wait.
Yeah, me neither. So Psychic Soiree, October 30th. The link is in the show description. And Amy, I think we've actually made it to an hour, so it's time to call it a night. And you did good. You did good. This is Angel Card Amy, and I am Phantom Phil. All right. Thank you once again to Angel Card Amy for joining me in that case study. I had a lot of fun doing it. I think having a partner to discuss the case studies with, or a special guest month in, month out, is going to be a better way to go moving forward instead of just having me listen to the sound of my own voice, which I get more than enough of, believe me. I feed off the energy of whoever I'm talking to, and this case study was no different. And yet I still have the burning question, just who in the hell was that man in the forest? I should really look that up with some additional research, because it's still bothering me, believe it or not. And one other point I wanted to bring up, which I forgot to do so when Amy was on, was that I talked about the quote at the beginning about curiosity turning man into a plaything. And at the very end, in the last scene, I don't know if this happened in real life because it seems kind of Hollywooded up, so to speak, but when Travis and Mike go back to the site and are talking about what happened that night and trying to make peace with it, there's this great back and forth dialogue about, you know, there's remorse, there's apology, there's, you know, Travis questioning himself, going, why did I get out of the truck? If I just stayed in here, this whole thing may have never have happened. But then the two make peace, they forgive each other, they bury the hatchet. And it makes you realize, even though curiosity turned Travis's life upside down, I really think it led him to a higher calling and eventually took him to a better place, even if he went through some severe physical and emotional hardships. So big ups to Travis for staying curious. Like I said earlier when Amy was on, I just want to give one more shout out to the Psychic Soiree. October 30th, the night before Halloween, the event goes from 4 p.m. to 10, I believe, and pick up your tickets at the Homer Watson Art Gallery. And hopefully we'll see you out there. Spots I know are quite limited, but there might be the odd ones left, and it'll definitely be worth coming out. Next week on Unexplained Incorporated, going to have a very special guest. I'm going to have Richard Clinton from the Muddy York Tours. And if you're wondering what that is, it's walking tours of the city of Toronto, but they also delve into some famous ghost stories, paranormal events, and haunted venues that include some of the major theaters of Toronto. Dan Cumerlato recommended him to me, and Richard has agreed to come on to the show, and I'm sure he has some very fascinating stories, as he's been doing this, I believe, since around 1997, and it looks like he's gearing up for Halloween as well. We'll talk to him about that. But the term Muddy York goes back to an old nickname the city of Toronto used to have before it was called Toronto and it was just referred to as York. He does a lot of historical tours, does a lot that delves into organized crime. But of course, we're going to focus on the hauntings and the paranormal activities. I cannot wait to have him on. And to kick off the show, you heard my first sponsor of the program, Soundstripe, in the affiliate program I have associated with them. You're going to hear about another sponsor joining the show, which is connected to sustainable products that I think each and every one of us can get good use out of, because signing sponsors on Unexplained Incorporated, I just don't want to read and promote any old products. I want to do products and services that I actually use and that hopefully you can find useful as well. So there's going to be an announcement kicking off next week's show in regards to that. And then we're going to chat with Richard Clinton out of Toronto. Cannot wait. In the meantime, much like the legendary Travis Walton, stay strong, stay healthy, and regardless of what Seneca says, most importantly, stay curious and don't stay in the truck. Your life will never be the same if you don't leave the truck, if you know what I mean. Anyway, it's been fun, and we will see you next week for the Friday Night Fright.